Welcome to Business Watch. In his Monday morning missive this week, the President chose to highlight the work that has been done by the Special Investigative Unit, the SIU, to fight corruption. And he pointed to the fact that corruption is raised by concerned citizens wherever he goes around the country, which is certainly not a blistering insight. But it requires leadership to tackle corruption, and we see a lack of decisive, ethical and courageous leadership translating into tangible and speedy delivery has been identified as a key risk for South Africa over the next 12 months, and the country runs the risk of becoming a failed state if this inaction continues. This is contained in the 2022 Institute of Risk Management Risk Report, which has just been released. The document that polls risk professionals both in the private and public sector is acknowledged as one of the key primers for strategic risk management and planning. And to talk about the report and how we tackle the scourge of corruption, I'm joined now by Berenice Francis, the immediate past president of the Institute, as well as a current board member, and advocate Kevin Malunga, academic head of the LLB faculty at Regenesis Business School and former deputy public protector as well. So thank you both for joining us. Berenice, just set the background to the report here and what some of the key findings were this year.
So thanks very much. The report, really, it's our eighth report. It's an annual report that we issue with regards to South Africa. And the context really is around the recovery plan that South Africa issued in October 2020. And in it, we've had very specific objectives with regards to GDP growth of about 5.6%, reducing unemployment, having specific ratios of investment to GDP. And all risk is identifying the uncertainties around meeting your objectives. So we highlight on an annual basis what are the key things or the key uncertainties, whether they're adverse or even opportunities, that will prevent us from meeting those key objectives. So, for example, as you mentioned, one of the things we've highlighted was around the failed state. We've also spoken about a complete ethical and legal principle breakdown in terms of the collapse of a possible economic collapse. We've spoken about the lack of skills regarding economic growth and recovery. We've also highlighted the importance of a stable supply of utilities. All of these are dependent and very important for us to meet those objectives that we've set ourselves. Remember, those objectives in the recovery and reconstruction plan were also based on the NDP. So again, it's just saying, if we don't fix this, if we don't address this, we're not going to meet those objectives, and we can have these amazing aspirational goals that we all know is going to we're not going to meet.
Absolutely. And Kevin, to bring you in, if you look at the risk context that confronts South Africa as we look to rebuild following not just the 2 years of pandemic, but prior to that, as we well know through the various Zondo reports, those years of state capture that hollowed out key institutions of state, what is the key context that confronts decision makers now?
I think the key context really, Mike, is really the issue of whether there is walking off the talk. We have seen a lot of talk about this phenomenon over the past 10 years, and the frustration to do something about it. If I can just slightly move it to the side, you'll recall that the ratings agencies, whether it's Moody's or whatever, all of them have mentioned the same phenomenon in some of their downgrades or not upgrade or downgrades. In other words, the culture of institution building is what needs to be looked at. Whether South Africa has strong institutions, whether they people can be held accountable for malfeasance, whether it's corruption or any other type of maladministration.
And that is such an important context in a global environment where, let's face it, if you're planning as a business leader and you're looking to ameliorate risks, I think we are seeing heightened risk emerging around Europe and the geopolitics around Ukraine and Russia, and who would have thought that assets would have been seized just a couple of weeks ago on both sides. But that is now emerging as a key risk, and so institutions are critically important in the global context. In South Africa though, Berenice, and your past reports lent on scenario planning a little bit, and you quote Clem Sunter in this report, you had three scenarios. You had the perpetual hangover, fake it until we make it or not, and owning our future. Remind us what those three potential scenarios are and which one we're currently tracking.
So we always have the three scenarios, and the one being what we call owning our future. So owning our future is about how we take ownership and cohesive control of our destiny, how we become very focused on where we need to go as a country, that we deliver on our promises, and that we work, right? I think the where we found ourselves in the last 2 years is what we call the fake it till you make it, where we knew there were things that were not going right. There were a little bit of elephants in the room, but for the most part, things were happening. We were still seeing progress towards, say, those goals that we were making. What we're now finding is, and it's something that has always been the worst case scenario for us, is around a perpetual hangover, where there isn't cohesion, where we're very short-term in our focus, where we become, we're constantly breaking down as in terms of the cause of our society. Things where corruption overwhelms us and we end up disconnecting or disengaging. And not just from a political perspective, but I also think in terms of societies, etc. And what we're seeing now is, as I said, the last 2 years, we've kind of been in the middle, right? The fake it till we make it. What we now have seen is risk officers and risk managers have taken the 10 risks and they've rated them, and they're overwhelmingly bordering towards the perpetual hangover, where we talk, where nothing really happens, and where we become disconnected and therefore stop caring about where we go as a collector. Mm.
And the cynics exactly, Berenice, and just on that point, the cynics often point to the fact that when it comes to plans, when it comes to the rhetoric around specifically corruption and rebuilding those institutions that were hollowed out during the state capture years, that we're just not moving swiftly enough. I mean, all the right things are said at State of the Nation addresses, but when it follows through to budgetary requirements needed to reform key organs of state to tackle corruption, for example, you look at the MPA, which is consistently under-resourced, you know, the actions don't follow the flowery rhetoric.
I think that you can't fix, and we all agree, you can't fix this hollowing out that happened over years and years overnight. But, and I do think where we're going in terms of the Zondo report is people want to see something happen. We don't want to just know that it happened. We want to see people being held accountable, that people, that there are consequence management. And as Kevin said, the only reason people need to learn how to reach trust. I think we have to rebuild that trust, that if we say we're going to do something, that it's not based on, depends on who we're talking about. I think that's where the perception of favoritism happens, is that we only talk about things if they're easy. You know, it's about how courageous are we to follow through that no one is exempt. And we can only start rebuilding that trust and rebuilding that cohesion when people start seeing action.
Mm. And on that point, Kevin, just to bring you in, the now Chief Justice, Raymond Zondo, and congratulations to the new Chief Justice on his appointment, made a number of general recommendations, and among them was the publication of a national charter against corruption. He talks about a code of conduct, setting out ethical standards. Do you think that this will act as a sufficient guard against corruption, given how endemic it is in the country?
Absolutely. I think that a new agency, as has been punted, is a good idea. But of course, my major concern is how the current systems that are in place are given leeway and the ability to do their work. So I think we are seeing great strides, for example, when we saw the Zondo Commission and the ability to dig things up. But then what then happens after that? I think that's what everybody has been asking. And of course, the quality of prosecutions, the National Prosecuting Agency, hasn't covered itself in glory. There's been a lot of hype, but very little bang. I like to call it a damn squib, as it were. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where we are. I think we really need to see movement in terms of the kind of energy, that chutzpah. You know, where in many places where these things work, such as Singapore, they always talk about political will. So it will really go back to the politicians, how serious they are in ensuring that people are pursued and that there's consequences, that you don't put people, for example, who have such glaring challenges, ethical challenges, to, you know, as portfolio committees, chairs in parliament, etc. So it's really a walking the talk scenario, as I said.
And just to build on that, I mean, Kevin, you're no longer with the Public Protector's Office. You resigned that position as deputy some years ago, but you were instrumental in the office during the years that the State of Capture report was investigated and produced by the office. We now have a Public Protector who, on a repeated occasion, I've lost track of the number of times she's made findings that have been overturned when legally challenged, and I think it's plain for all to see that she is unfit to hold the office. Parliament is meant to be holding a vote on this as well. What are your thoughts on the decline of such a key Chapter 9 institution like the Public Protector? If we're to rebuild trust between the citizenry and the state, surely that has got to be a key place to start.
That has been quite unfortunate, but what I can say is, okay, one redeeming quality of the current incumbent is bravery. I think bravery is important. The challenge is when it's misplaced efforts. In other words, when you don't follow quality, etc. Those are the kind of things that I used to emphasize when I was there, and that's what needs to happen. I think with all these institutions, they need to have a rigor, they need to have properly trained people. That institution that I was with has all those people. They just need to be used. And you have to avoid any form of interference. So I don't want to cast aspersions on anyone. I think the courts have said a lot about these things, about what constitutes an effective investigation, what constitutes a bad investigation. So I think those are the kind of things that need to be looked at. That is true of all these institutions that are doing this, whether it's the NPA, the SIU, and any other mooted organizations. It's very important. And of course, internally, state organs themselves are better off with internal capacity, where they actually pick these things, nip them in the bud before they happen. I know when I was in my old job, our old Western Cape head moved over to government because they set up an internal forensic unit to try and nip some of these things in the bud before they happen. And that can certainly assist tightening of controls and ensuring that the right people are appointed to jobs and not friends, jobs for pals.
Absolutely. Through procurement, then you stop it from even happening in the first place rather than trying to investigate it after the fact. And from a business perspective, Berenice, I'm reminded of the late Michael Spicer, who died so suddenly last week when he was head of Business Leadership South Africa. And he was persuaded to come back to South Africa at a time when he was working at Chatham House over in the UK. And really he felt this great sense of purpose to help business coordinate this transition to democracy, but be a force for good, be an enabling force for good. And I recall at the time, I think Tony Trayer was lobbed off at the knees by former President Thabo Mbeki for criticizing what he felt was going wrong inside the state when it came to ethical leadership and the right sort of conduct. What role does business play now, considering that here's an Institute of Risk Management SA report? The headline finding is we see all the red flags. We are potentially heading towards failed statehood. Surely business can't just sit on the sidelines for any amount of time longer and has to raise its head above the parapet and start calling out things that are going wrong in the public sector. And yes, it's the realm of politics, but if we remain silent in the face of this, well, the evidence is not good.
Yeah, I think over the last, over the recent years, BLSA has been quite vocal with regards to we're in this together, right? And we will work with, not against, but we work with, because ultimately, if we're heading towards a failed state, you can't operate a business in a failed state. So it's in the best interest of all the stakeholders within this country to find a way of getting to a cohesive type of environment. I think what's important with business as well is that it's not just, and we always speak about that, you know, corruption's not the sole, you know, it's not just the public sector. Mm. It's private sector, the public sector, and it's also, it's got to do a lot with our ethics and our values as a society. I think in South Africa, we sometimes bend the rules because it doesn't suit us. And I do think that at the core of it, if we have, we have to take a deep a look at ourselves and make sure that we're not part of the process or part of the problem. So I don't think in a business's role is to point fingers, is to help, is to say, okay, where are the inefficiencies that's allowing for opportunities for corrupt practices? Are we being pragmatic when we have procurement processes? Has the PFMA really worked adequately to give proper guidance, but also to empower? I do think that, and I was in the public service for about 8 years, with the introduction of PFMA and the MFMA, it was quite a confusing time for most officials because historically we were working with rules-based, then we worked into a framework. And then I think the governance framework got bastardized where we weren't exactly sure, and it left room for people who were opportunistic. And more people, because took advantage of that, and then were never held accountable. So I think what we've got to do is take it back. Take back the fact that we're an ethical society and we shouldn't be participating in corrupt activities, whether in the private or the public sector. Make sure that the people you hire or the people that you put in charge of getting things done are empowered to actually get the work done, and that we're not over-bureaucratic. And it's always something we talk about in businesses around, we need to at some point, you know, we spoke about trust earlier, but without trust, we're not going to move forward. We can't also, and I've also seen it, where we have too many people checking. We have too many oversights and too little people actually doing the work sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the only way that things happen is if you empower people, if you also take risk, because you need to take risk. And we're so afraid of taking the wrong risks that we end up never taking the risk. So I think that we need to have a very clear view around what our ethical tone is, and not just, you know, one of the business schools deans always to speak about, there's a tone at the top, but there's also a tune in the middle. It's not just about what's happening at the top. It's about how consistent are we with following that ethical tone? How consistent are we to call out when we don't do the right thing? And also, how consistent are we to call out when we don't take risks? Because we're never going to move forward as South Africa if we're going to constantly be watchful or worried, yeah? So I think business's role is very clear in that we employ a lot of people. We have very clear objectives in terms of what stakeholder and shareholder value creation is. And we also know that we have to have very sustainable practices. And those type of disciplines are, I think, echoed in the public sector. But what we've got to do is enable that sometimes. Mm. And so we have a lot more of a role to play.
And it's echoed in the President's Monday morning letter as well, saying, of course, there's corruption in the public sector, but there's corruption in the private sector. Very often the two interface around tenders, and it can be a bit of a revolving door. I think corruption is wrong wherever it is in society. And we've seen, and I think there's been no coincidence in the decline in governance standards on the JSE, for example, during the years where we saw a huge decline in ethical standards in the public sector as well. And the big scandals of Tongaat and Steinhoff and all serve as an example of that. We now need, though, Kevin, to see some people in orange overalls. And, you know, the president talking up the SIU in his letter this morning doesn't fill me with a lot of confidence until we start to see real accountability on the ground. How do you see the tone changing around this deep-rooted cynicism in South Africa about corruption? Because all we seem to hear are very selective examples of where the system is working. Largely, we all see a system that is dysfunctional.
Oh, absolutely. There's South Africa has one of the biggest budgets for its anti-corruption arsenal. You know, there's so much money that is spent on this stuff. But as we indicated, not enough results in terms of seeing people who, you know, the issue of asset forfeiture, for example. I feel very strongly about the fact that if you do find that someone has ill-gotten gains, the state should confiscate them. So those kind of dynamics need to happen, with, as you correctly point out, without being selective. I have been currently been training quite a few organs on the issue of ethics, and it's quite always quite telling. For example, if you ask how many people have paid for their driver's license, you know, half of the hands, in fact, not even half, 80% of the hands in a room will shoot up and say, "Yes, we paid for this." So it's so endemic that even ordinary citizens are active participants in this particular challenge, and that's where it has to go back. I would say it even has to go to kindergarten, and of course, the business world has been very good when it comes to the kind of codes, etc., that it has institutionally. The JSC, all the JSE listed companies, they have nice setups, but we need to see more understanding of conflict of interest, both in the public and private sector, and I think we just need to. And of course, as you correctly point out, if there are people who actually get locked up and people who lose their properties, there will be consequences, and people will see that it works. So far, it's just been talked.
Yeah, and on that point, I think right now we have a system where doing the wrong thing often is seen to pay in communities on the ground, and the president mentioned again in his letter the perpetrators of grand corruption flaunt their ill-gotten gains in these communities. They drive the fancy cars, they live in big expensive houses off these ill-gotten gains, off the back of taxpayers, and there is zero accountability. How do you drive a recalibration of doing the right thing in an environment where doing the wrong thing it seemingly pays? Just as we've got a few minutes left here, Berenice, what's the take-home message from this report, and how should business be looking to engage with these key messages around potential failed statehood, the key risks of corruption, and what sort of skills they need to be applying in order to turn things around?
So we have listed a number of what we call pivots. So when the report, we say, okay, these are the things that we believe that can change the scenario that we see happening. We can see this coming. And when you speak about skills, we talk about the level of competence that is needed, not just from an ethical perspective, but also from when we say a lot of technical skills need to happen. We need people who can make things happen with regards to our infrastructure. If you look at as much as we've carved out the institutes, we've also carved out some of what we call core skills, right? So why do we not invest in more technical skills and ensure that we provide opportunities? So there's been a lot of collaboration with government and business and projects like, how do we provide opportunities for unemployed people? One of the things that also comes out very clearly is around, we can't leave our people behind. And what we are doing at the moment is we're not seeing people. We're seeing groups or stats, or we need to start rolling up our sleeves and saying, well, how do we make a difference in our environments, in our areas of control? because it's not about, and we always talk that leadership out there or the government has to do that, but what are we doing with our own environments? And it starts from what are we doing in our homes? How do we speak to our own children, our own circle of friends? How do we implement what I call ethical practices in our businesses so that we're not just because leading by example and ensuring that this almost apathy to seeing something happening, this possible failed state doesn't happen, because ultimately we are now, right? Mm. And the only thing we can do is change our own behaviors, our businesses' behaviors, and then holding all of our leaders accountable, whether it's local government, where a lot of these things are now starting to bubble, to whether it's national government or even our SOEs.
Absolutely. Bernice, on that point, we have to end it off. We run out of time. Bernice Francis, Institute of Risk Management South Africa, immediate past president and board member of the Institute of Risk Management as well, who's joined by Kevin Malunga, who is academic head of the LLB faculty at Regenesis Business School and former deputy public protector, talking about the key highlighted findings from this year's report. And number one on the list is that South Africa is currently tracking on the failed statehood scenario. I think it really is up to each and every one of us if we're to pull ourselves back from the brink.